This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Sarah Dingle. Coming up today, could China's Belt and Road construction project spell the end for the last remaining Indo-Chinese tigers? A new report finds only a quarter of Australians previously supported by three major government programs have been accepted into the NDIS. And a Hong Kong ban on protesters' face masks may have had the opposite effect.
It's very stupid to have this law right now, and of course we have to protect ourselves, and that is why we still wear it on a mask, because like we don't care and we don't afraid of the government.
But first, the US President Donald Trump is still denying he sought political investigations in return for favours, saying it's all just about fighting corruption. But the impeachment inquiry has released messages from the president's Ukraine team in which they appear to tell the Ukraine that their government won't get a White House meeting until they launch an investigation. Ukraine has announced it will investigate the companies Joe Biden's son worked for, but China has flatly rejected a request from President Trump to do likewise. North America correspondent Connor Duffy reports.
That's a very nice question. Let me shake your hand. Come here.
It's the happiest America has seen President Trump in weeks as he emerged from the White House to speak to reporters and celebrate a 50-year low in unemployment, which is at 3.5%.
Wages are up. When I was running, wages were nowhere. They were going down. And people were having two and three jobs, and they were making less money than they made 20 years before.
However, just down the road on Capitol Hill, the impeachment inquiry released text messages appearing to show Mr. Trump's team trying to force Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden. Former US envoy to Ukraine Kurt Volker texted a Ukrainian presidential aide, heard from the White House, assuming President Zelensky convinces Trump he will investigate, we will nail down date for visit to Washington. Mr. Trump says it was all about fighting corruption rather than damaging a political rival.
I don't care about Biden's campaign, but I do care about corruption. His campaign, that's up to him. Politics, that's up to them. I don't care about politics. Politics, as I think I made clear, and yesterday somebody asked me a question, and I gave an answer, but always in the form of corruption. What I want to do, and I think I have an obligation to do it, probably a duty to do it.
One question, though, had the corruption fighter stumped.
Have you had foreign leaders for any corruption investigations that don't involve your political opponent?
Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, had business interests in China and Ukraine while his father was vice president. He's said to have made about $400,000 in China and collected about $3 million to sit on the board of a Ukrainian gas company, Burisma.
Just as an observer, what I saw Biden do with his son, he is pillaging these countries and he's hurting us. How would you like to have, as an example, Joe Biden negotiating the China deal if he took it over from me after the election? He would give them everything.
Overnight, Ukraine announced it would reopen 15 investigations into that gas company Burisma, though it stressed there was no evidence of wrongdoing by Hunter Biden. China, however, was swift to dismiss a similar request made by Mr. Trump just yesterday. He denied this could play into his trade war with China.
No, I want to do a trade deal with China, but only if it's good for our country. And it could happen. As you know, they're very much coming over next week, as I understand it. So I'd like to do a trade deal with China, but only if it's a great trade deal for this country. One thing has nothing to do with the other.
As he walked away from reporters, President Trump raised a hand in triumph. He says even if he's impeached in the House, he's confident Republicans will keep him from being forced from office in a Senate trial. Shortly after, though, a small sign of dissent from Republican Senator Mitt Romney, suggesting his request of Beijing was concerned with politics, not corruption. This is Connor Duffy in Washington for AM.
Envoys from the US and North Korea will hold talks today in Stockholm in the first formal negotiations between the two nations since President Trump took 20 steps across the border into North Korea in June. The talks were only agreed to this week, shortly after which North Korea test-fired yet another missile. For more on what may come from today's meeting, I spoke to Rory Daniels, the Deputy Project Director of the Forum on Asia-Pacific Security. The US has been seeking another round of talks for a while, but North Korea only agreed this week. So is that too short of a lead time to put together an agenda and make sure something actually comes out of these talks?
I think what's important to remember about the time frame is that the US has diplomats that are dedicated full time to this issue, whether the North Koreans are talking to them or not. So in the interim period since the Hanoi summit failed, the U.S., along with their counterparts in Japan, Russia, China, and South Korea, have been thinking about how to move forward when the DPRK is ready to come back to the table.
So what can we expect from these talks in Stockholm today then? What are the packages that are likely to be on the table?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic that we could have a small but significant deal reached in Stockholm. The rumor that's being reported is that this deal will include up to 3 years of sanctions relief on specific industries, including textiles and coal exports, in exchange for the verified dismantlement of the Yongbyon nuclear complex, plus an additional nuclear production facility. And in addition to that, there may be movement on a peace treaty or other signs of a transformed relationship between the U.S. and the DPRK. And to me, this would be quite significant for two reasons. First, it would show a willingness to meet in the middle after the failure of the Hanoi summit. Both sides would have to make some compromises in their positions. And then the second area of significance is that the deal would create a process, not just to verify the technical details of dismantlement, but also the strategic intentions of both sides. So that three-year period gives some time to develop a track record of compliance on both sides that would demonstrate sincerity and hopefully move this process along.
Well, these will be the first bilateral talks that President Trump has not brought his national security advisor, John Bolton, to since John Bolton left the administration. Bolton was known for his hardline approach to the North. Can we expect much of a change in tone from the US?
Well, I think the DPRK is expecting a change in tone. So they have said that they're ready to come back to talks because they received a positive signal from the U.S. And while they never confirmed what that signal was, the timing certainly suggests it was related, as you say, to the dismissal of Ambassador Bolton. So I do expect that without that particular national security advisor involved in the process, there may well be a change in tone. But having had some limited interactions with the U.S. negotiating team, I would say that these are very serious and dedicated professionals who always approached this with pragmatism. And I would not expect to see a huge change in tone on the value of establishing a process or of the pragmatism of this particular team.
Well, also this week, North Korea test-fired yet another missile, the key difference being that this one is designed to be launched from a submarine, meaning it could dramatically extend the reach of their arsenal. Realistically, is this a nation interested in any kind of nuclear de-escalation?
We'll only find out through testing their sincerity in a real working level process. I mean, there is no doubt, at least in my mind, that those missile tests and the demonstration of an expanded capacity was timed to establish leverage before these talks or to convey displeasure to other regional actors. I think that the series of missile tests this summer that seem to be escalating over time do stress the U.S. policy community's ability to take North Korea seriously in these negotiations. But again, I believe that the only way to determine whether or not North Korea is serious about de-escalation is to get them to the table, get them to agree on a process, and then continuously test them through that process.
Rory Daniels, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on here.
That's Rory Daniels, who's the Deputy Project Director of the Forum on Asia-Pacific Security at the National Committee on American Foreign Policy. Well, in Hong Kong, new sweeping powers to arrest people for wearing face masks have already been tested by protesters overnight, who engaged in a mass show of defiance. The mask ban was invoked at midnight by Carrie Lam's government, despite a last-minute court bid to have it delayed. The resulting demonstrations were so large, the city's entire rail transport system was shut down. Greg Jennett reports.
And I would say that we are now in rather extensive and serious public danger.
Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, pulled the trigger on the legal crackdown from a minute past midnight last night. It'd be outlawed, with few exceptions, to appear in public with a facial covering.
I would like to emphasise that the decision to invoke the Emergency Regulations Ordinance is a difficult but also a necessary one for public interest.
But it'd take more than a piece of paper to unmask the masses.
Will you obey the law? It doesn't sound to me...
I won't.
In dozens of locations right across the territory, protesters took to the streets with their facial coverings and told us they couldn't care less about the law.
It's very stupid to have this law right now, and of course we have to protect ourselves, and that is why we still wearing our mask, because like we don't care and we don't afraid of the government.
It's not the fault of the mask, it's the fault of the government.
MTR railway stations were set alight, the entire network was shut down, and at Causeway Bay on Hong Kong Island, police eventually moved in with tear gas to clear a crowd numbering in the tens of thousands. Not because they were wearing masks, but because a Chinese bank shopfront had been set alight and multiple fires ablaze along Hennessy Road. From today, the mask ban is fully in place. A legal bid to have it delayed last night failed, but other challenges will still be launched against it. Hong Kong's government has gone for a powerful tool to control the pro-democracy movement. But now, the test is of police themselves. Do they have the capacity to handle it, in the way Carrie Lam and the central Chinese government in Beijing intended? In Hong Kong, this is Greg Jennett reporting for Saturday AM.
China's multi-trillion dollar Belt and Road Initiative to connect Beijing to Europe and Africa through a network of road and rail is slated to cut through vast swathes of forest across the Asian continent. That's worrying conservationists who fear it will hasten the extinction of already endangered Indo-Chinese tigers. Southeast Asia correspondent Catherine Diss went out on patrol with park rangers from Ta Prea National Park.
Deep in the jungle in Thailand's east, a group of rangers are on patrol. They're on the hunt for the poachers who stalk this forest in the search of rare and endangered animals. Walking in complete silence, they carry HK-33 assault rifles in case they face off with traffickers who could be armed with anything from a homemade weapon to an AK-47. But the animals and forests they protect are facing another threat.
Where the road goes, people will follow. When there's transportation, it's easier to poach. We must continue to stay alert.
That's Kunlabon Ponlawan. He's the chief of Ta Prea National Park and he manages the rangers. Two major highways already dissect the forest complex and he's worried about future development, with China's Belt and Road Initiative set to hook into the existing road network on its way to a deep water port in the Gulf of Thailand.
I am getting more and more concerned about the wildlife. There are more and more trucks.
It's a fear also held by Tim Redford. He's from the anti-trafficking not-for-profit Freeland Foundation and has spent 30 years fighting to save Thailand's wildlife and its dwindling tiger population. But he fears for their future.
They need a large landscape for them to roam around and establish territories. And so as you start to get the network of roads that fragment the forest, this makes this migration more difficult and hazardous.
There are fewer than 200 tigers left in the wild in Thailand. The species is now extinct in Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam. With China's Belt and Road set to crisscross the continent, conservationists say the problem is only set to worsen. Alice Hughes is a biologist with the Chinese Academy of Sciences and has mapped where the planned projects will go. Large swathes of Southeast Asia are under threat, including Vietnam's coastline, southern and northern Thailand, and much of Malaysia. Alice Hughes says more than 60% of key biodiversity hotspots across the three continents could be damaged.
Wherever you go in this region, there are potential issues for large wildlife and for small wildlife, both by direct exploitation but also the increased probability of traffic accidents.
The project, which promises to be the largest infrastructure development in human history, will surely bring big benefits for global trade. But conservationists are questioning whether the advantages outweigh the downside. This is Catherine De Sintapria reporting for Saturday AM.
Back home, there are serious concerns about large numbers of people slipping through the cracks in the transition to the National Disability Insurance Scheme. A new report commissioned by the Commonwealth has found only a quarter of those previously assisted by three major government programs has been accepted into the NDIS. It confirms the fears of many in the community mental health sector, as Isabel Rowe reports.
As the rollout of one of Australia's largest social reforms continues, mental health services say some of the most vulnerable are being left behind.
They're hired up in the unit on the 15th floor of the public housing estate down in Melbourne. They're in the caravan out the back at Dubbo. So we've lost some of those guys.
Bill Guy is the head of Community Mental Health Australia, a group commissioned by the National Mental Health Body to find out what's happening to those people who haven't been accepted into the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The research tracked the progress of people who were being cared for under three Commonwealth-funded programs for severe psychological disabilities.
It was assumed that most people, if not all of the people in those programs, would transition across to the NDIS, which is why their funding tapered down over 3 years to zero on the 30th of June this year.
But when the funding stopped, not everyone had transitioned.
Some have applied and submitted an application to the NDIS, and that's 50% of the people in those programs. Half of those have been accepted. So and altogether, 25% of people that were in the programs have so far made it in to the NDIS.
Bill Guy believes many people are struggling to prove their case, particularly if they're homeless or have no official diagnosis. Others, he says, say they have no intention of applying at all because the process is too difficult or they don't trust it. It will mean just a fraction of the estimated 800,000 severely mentally ill Australians will be able to access the NDIS.
The NDIS at its peak will take 64,000. Now, 64,000 is only 8% of the 800,000. So you can see that there's a little bit of a gap.
Social entrepreneur Luke Terry is one of the people stepping up to try and bridge that gap. His laundry in Toowoomba in regional Queensland exclusively hires people with a mental illness who don't qualify for the NDIS.
We're trying to do as much as we can, which is why we built White Box Enterprises and why we're trying to build more Vanguard laundries.
He's one of several in the sector who saw the problem coming.
Traditionally, there was a lot of funding out there for mental health programs to be able to help people get into work. And some of those, if you don't have NDIS funding, it's a real difficulty to be able to get some of those funded services. There are still some block-funded services around, but it's really difficult if you're unable to get an NDIS package to get into work. So our response to that has been to go out and build large-scale employment-focused social enterprises.
I mean, and that's great that there is an employment opportunity, but it's more than that people need.
Enough.
They need the actual services. So where is that going to come from?
Look, at the moment, there's a real lack of services in those areas.
A transition program to help people who aren't funded by the NDIS ends in June 2020. The Federal Health Department has set up two new schemes to help, but Community Mental Health Australia says it's been told by service providers that the funding is grossly inadequate. In a statement to Saturday AM, the Federal Health Department says people who aren't eligible for the NDIS would receive a similar level of government support under its new schemes. And it says those people with a psychological disability who are funded by the NDIS could receive up to $100,000 in support.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Drought assistance has been back in the headlines this week, with the Federal Treasurer visiting affected areas in Queensland and New South Wales. But in Victoria, one council with self-confessed green pastures has returned its drought funding, prompting critics to accuse the government of ad hoc measures. It strengthened calls for a comprehensive national drought policy, but what that means exactly is yet to be defined. Georgia Hitch reports.
Speaking in Burnie, the Prime Minister reiterated his government was on the front foot and would deliver assistance for as long as needed.
That's why the Treasurer has been out in drought-affected areas just this week. That's why I was out there last week. That's why all of my ministers are out there and listening to the issues that are on the ground and responding.
But like others, Paul Nankerville, an economist and farmer on Liverpool Plains, isn't convinced.
Well, it is policy on the run. It's full of ad hoc and piecemeal initiatives that haven't been fully costed. It's largely a statement of intent with some dollar signs on it.
He's got a clear idea of what he thinks the government should be doing.
Well, the first element of a drought policy is that it should be bipartisan. It should be based on the widest possible consultation and the design of all the elements, both on the welfare side and on the farm resilience side, designing the programs and then fully costing those programs for droughts of different severity.
So far, the government's national policy has focused on ensuring cash flow to struggling farmers in their communities. But the actions of Moynshire Council earlier this week, which returned its drought funding saying it had the best spring in years, was used as fuel by critics of the handouts. As well as household allowances, the government has put together a $5 billion fund for future drought measures. But the lack of detail around what it'll be used for is frustrating farmers and researchers alike. Linda Bottrell is an academic who worked in the Keating government, helping to create the first national drought response in the early 1990s. In her view, policies like the Farm Management Deposit Scheme, where money is put aside in good years and given tax concessions, are what the government should be expanding.
So when there's rain, they can put a certain amount of money aside in a tax-effective manner that they can draw down in the bad years. Measures like that are the types of measures that we need to have in place to support farmers to manage their income over the climate cycle.
More broadly, she believes any national policy needs to be predictable and equitable.
The important thing about a drought response is that during drought, farmers know what is likely to be available and when, and governments have a predictable response. They have things that they can implement that people know about and that are reliable.
Linda Bottrell and Paul Nankerville are also calling for ongoing analysis and monitoring of climate data. It's something countries around the globe dealing with drought have begun doing as part of an international collaboration run partly by the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Donald Wilhite. He spent decades researching and working on national policies and is the founding director of America's National Drought Mitigation Center.
When it comes to monitoring drought, you have to not only look at precipitation, but you also have to look at stream flow, groundwater levels, soil moisture content. Also part of monitoring is monitoring the social elements of drought.
But he concedes the success of a national policy rests solely on political will or lack thereof.
It's hard to get elected officials to think long term, and they want to do things that they're going to help them get elected in the short term rather than thinking of long term strategies.
That's Donald Wilhite from America's National Drought Mitigation Center, ending Georgia Hitch's report. A national coalition of experts says there should be a new temporary class of visa established for migrant women who are victims of domestic and family violence in Australia. The call echoes the recommendations of a Senate inquiry into dowry abuse delivered 8 months ago, to which the federal government is yet to make any official response. Bridget Fitzgerald has the story.
Sitting in a refuge in Perth, a woman we'll call Emily describes how she hasn't been sleeping because she's traumatised by the violence inflicted by her ex-partner. She calls it the war.
Every night the war is coming to my head. I will nearly die. I will die.
You felt that if you stayed in the relationship that you might die?
Yes.
Emily moved to Australia from Hong Kong to study. She met a man, another migrant who was a permanent resident, and fell in love. Then the violence started. And it was extreme. He regularly beat her, bound and tortured her. After 3 years and the birth of their daughter, Emily escaped. But the story doesn't end there. Anne, who doesn't want to give her last name, is her caseworker.
He just renewed the visa, the student visa, and never put her onto a spousal visa. So it was this whole thing that she never knew that she wasn't actually protected by the government.
When a relationship breaks down due to family violence, government policy is that the visa held by the victim should not be cancelled. But because Emily's visa was only ever temporary, she can't work and she's not eligible for any form of assistance from Centrelink or Medicare. She can stay for the completion of her court proceedings, then she'll be forced to leave Australia.
What we're asking for is the establishment of a new type of visa.
Keddie Crystal is the acting CEO of the Women's Council for Domestic and Family Violence Services in Western Australia. She represents a coalition of domestic violence and legal services that form the National Advocacy Group on Women on Temporary Visas Experiencing Violence.
All women who are experiencing or have experienced domestic and family violence who are on any sort of temporary visa can be go on this new visa for up to 3 years while they sort out their arrangements.
Keddie Crystal says the federal government needs to respond to the findings of a Senate inquiry into dowry abuse, which has already recommended the creation of a temporary visa for women at risk. Brisbane social worker Jatinda Kaur agrees.
Temporary spouse visa holders are a very vulnerable cohort of women.
She made a submission to the Dowry Abuse Inquiry and says such a visa would give these victims of domestic violence time to deal with their trauma.
Not knowing whether I'm allowed to stay in the country or I'm going to be, deported back or sent back, that compounds their anxiety.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Department of Home Affairs said the government was still considering its response to the Senate inquiry report. The Immigration Minister, David Coleman, was unavailable for comment.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Picture this. You're a sole trader or a small business owner and you have a problem with a digital giant like Facebook or Google. You could complain to the company, but earlier this year, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission found that complainants actually needed a digital ombudsman. And now it looks like that's finally happening. Jacqueline Breen reports.
Billy Crombie and her husband put in up to 70 hours a week at the small restaurant they opened in Victoria's Dandenong Ranges a few years ago. She says it's doing well. They do a steady trade. They're preparing to expand, which is why the odd one-star review that's popped up on Google has taken her by surprise.
I really, really struggled with it. And I genuinely thought that nobody would come to my restaurant because they'd seen this review and we were going to be shut down.
Billy Crombie says she's had reasons to think some of the negative takes might be fake or baseless, but she's had no luck taking it up with the tech giant.
Literally, you just feel powerless. If you even get a response, and that requires you to follow up and follow up and follow up, and who has time to do that? But basically, we have tried to have reviews removed from Google and we've been told no. Not possible.
The ACCC has found Facebook and Google lacking when it comes to complaints and internal dispute resolution for users of their platforms. Even some in big business told the Digital Platforms Inquiry that they struggled to make contact with the tech giants in order to even raise an issue in the first place. It's even worse for the little guy.
When there are consumer disputes, when there's an imbalance of power, a lack of choice, then having an ombudsman as part of the regulatory framework can be useful.
Judy Jones is Australia's telecommunications industry ombudsman. Her office currently handles complaints about phone and internet services. The ACCC considers it may be well placed to take on the digital platforms too, and Judy Jones has just told the federal government she agrees.
We're saying we think it makes sense and that we agree that it would be useful for us to explore the feasibility of us taking on that role with the ACMA if that's what the government's policy position ends up being. We see it as convergence in the market.
She says it's too early to say what may be in a digital ombudsman's remit, but the ACCC said at a minimum the office should cover complaints from businesses relating to advertising and complaints from consumers around scam content. It said the ombudsman should be able to compel information, order compensation, and force digital platforms to take down scam content. Judy Jones says there would likely be scope for work on systemic issues as well.
So looking at a pattern of complaints that may affect more than one consumer, particularly perhaps vulnerable consumers in the same way, and working with the provider to get that issue addressed in a way that's fair and reasonable.
The ACCC said like the Telco Ombudsman's Office, the Digital Platforms one would be industry funded. Judy Jones says it's hard to say how the tech companies would respond to an ombudsman's engagement because the arrangement doesn't exist anywhere else.
That would be a world first, but the telecommunications industry ombudsman in Australia was also a world first. So Australia's been at the forefront of it before.
The ACCC says its ombudsman idea got a mixed response from the major platforms. Google was opposed and said its current processes, as well as existing laws and oversight bodies, are sufficient. The federal government's response to the Consumer Watchdog's inquiry is expected before the end of the year.
Jacqueline Breen reporting. In finance, Wall Street has bounced back from a torrid week after a report showed modest jobs growth in the US economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended 1.4% higher. That's Saturday AM for today. AM will be back on Monday morning. I'm Sarah Dingle. Thanks for your company. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.